supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got another one of them jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll be talking about de-icers and de-slipperizers that are safe to use near your lawns and plants. And we have some exciting new information and suggestions there. Then we're going to have a great interview about a fabulous new program I'm excited about that teaches returning veterans how to become organic farmers. That's so cool. Well, we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls first at 1-888-346-9499. Emily, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, glad to be here talking to you.
Glad to have you here talking to me, Emily. Where are you?
I'm in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania.
You know, Huntington Valley is a relatively small suburb just outside of Northeast Philadelphia, and we get tons of phone calls from Huntington Valley. What do you think? You're like a horticultural holdout there, all you folks?
I think so. We have great gardening soil here.
Well, that makes one of us. All right, I've had to build mine up from the ruins of Atlantis. What can we do for Emily in Huntington Valley?
I have a question about my ornamental pepper plant.
Okay.
I bought it earlier in the fall, and I had it outside. It was beautiful, red and purple and orange peppers. And then when it started to get cold, I brought it inside. And since I brought it in, it's been doing terrible. And at this point, I'm wondering if I can save it. I have it in a sunny window, and I've been watering it about once or twice a week. And the peppers have sort of shriveled, and some of the leaves are falling off, and I don't really know what to do for it.
So this is one of these ornamental peppers you bought in a store somewhere. Are the peppers round, or are they shaped like traditional chili peppers?
More like chili peppers.
Okay. First of all, these ornamental peppers are sensational looking. There are several varieties, like a variety that I know as Ordono, O-R-D-O-N-O. It's also known as New Mex Twilight, I believe. And it goes through 7 color changes on its way to the final stage. But in all these ornamental peppers, the final stage is always red. So when your peppers turn red, if they just stay on the plant like that, they are going to start to shrivel up and dry naturally. And the thing I love about these plants and about getting phone calls about them is I love to remind people every couple of years that ornamental just means they look pretty. They are as edible as any other hot pepper. But because these are pepper varieties that are basically bred to have all their peppers pointing straight up and at the top of the canopy of the plant, that's a sign that they're going to be extremely hot peppers. This is a broad group that some people call bird peppers, where the plant really shows colorful peppers really high up on the plant. Because it wants birds to come eat them. Birds love hot peppers. Birds got no lips, so they don't get bothered by them. If you want to experience a fresh hot pepper, you should snip those peppers off. If you leave them on the plant to where they start to dry up, that's a signal to the plant that there isn't anything in the environment that's consuming the peppers, so it's probably going to stop flowering. Are just your red peppers shriveling? What about the purple and the yellow and the orange?
Well, they've mostly all turned red at this point, but I didn't know I was supposed to remove them. And honestly, I didn't know that they were edible because they were called ornamental. So.
I know. We once, early on in the history of the show, we got a frantic call from a mother whose child had just eaten an ornamental hot pepper, as if they'd eaten a Christmas ornament off the tree or something like that. And I said, how's the kid? And she goes, he seems to be fine. I said, lady, you just got a kid who likes hot peppers, you know. So, yeah, you got to cut all those off. Do you still have the stupid wrapping around the bottom, the foil and everything like that?
No, I have that off.
Oh, good, 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 good. But you didn't repot it or anything?
No, I didn't.
One thing you may want to do if you want to increase your odds is you may want to pot this up into a pot twice as big and fill in the rest of it with just compost. That'll help it hold water. Now, in a bright, sunny window where it doesn't get freezing cold at night, and if you keep turning the plant so that the sun hits different sides, there's a chance that it may survive. It probably will not bloom or produce a lot of fruit over the winter because, first of all, there's not a lot of light in winter. As you know, we're in the period of, like, darkness and despair right now.
Yeah.
And the winter light is different. It's not as photosynthetic because of the angle it comes down at. So most people who overwinter peppers, and this can be done with any pepper plant from your garden, in addition to these ornamental peppers you buy, is to just put them right underneath the tubes of a shop light, a fluorescent light, and keep the top of the plant very close to the tubes. Keep the light on like 18 hours a day. Just give it a couple of hours of darkness.
Okay. All right. I'll try that. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Emily. It's a great adventure. And at the least, you got a nice harvest of peppers off it now.
Definitely. All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Alex, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great today, Alex. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right.
And where is Alex doing okay?
In the great city of Atlanta, Georgia.
There we go. Hotlanta. All right. What can we do for Alex in Atlanta?
Well, I've got succulents that I grow in pots, and I wish I could have an outdoor garden here, but I live in the city, and I just have pots and containers out on the balcony. And it's getting cold, even though it's the south. It still gets pretty cold here in the winter. And I was wondering if these things that are, I guess, supposed to grow in warm climates will be more damaged by the cold if I leave them outside during the day, or by the lack of light if I put them inside and they only get light through the window to protect them from the cold, and which would be the better course to get them to be healthy?
Well, Alex, you know, succulents refers to a huge family of plants that I guess tropical fits in there, but mostly we call them succulents because they are succulent. They hold lots of water. You know, most cacti fall into the succulent group. These are plants that have adapted to store water for long periods of time, or for one reason or another, just to have much more water in their cellular structure than most plants. There are a precious few succulents that can survive winter outdoors. Most of them are, you know, kind of warm weather cacti that get planted in the ground and sometimes actually become invasive. And I know you're in the South, but I also know, because I was there once when it happened, Atlanta can get snow and ice and freezing temperatures, not nearly as often as us here in Pennsylvania, but it can happen, right?
It sure can, sometimes.
And the interesting thing is the winter sun is such, it comes at such a different angle that it really doesn't give that photosynthesis to plants. So they're not having any benefit outdoors. I think it's a no-brainer. What you want to do is bring them inside, give them the brightest spot they can, but make sure they don't fry. You know, if you've got a window where the sun comes blaring in, then it would be great for them to be on that windowsill with just a sheer curtain in between them and the light, something to break the heat but let most of the light through. But I wouldn't
have got a curtain just in mind.
Good, good. And have a very light hand with the water. Succulents store water very efficiently, and plants don't use a lot of water over the winter time generally. So feel them, you know, when you bring them in, if you haven't watered them for a while, sit them all in a sink with some water in the bottom, and let them absorb the water through the drainage holes in the bottom for like an hour. Then let them then let them drain on a dish rack or something, and feel the weight of the pots, and then put them into place. You can put saucers underneath them to protect the surface, but don't let water pool up in the saucer. And then don't water them again until they feel lighter. And just keep them away from, like, heat vents and high sources of heat or heavy drafts or something like that. And they should do fine. This is what everyone who has these plants who keeps them alive does. They take them outside for the summer and they bring them inside for the winter. And as long as you don't feed them in winter or overwater them, they'll do just fine.
All right. Thank you, Mike. I always love hearing about your garden.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks very much. You take care, man.
All right. Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce the last call to Cuba. We still have a few openings left in the tour I'll be leading to investigate the botanical delights of that tropical island and maybe, just maybe, enjoy their average 80 to 85 degree daytime temperatures from January 14th to the 22nd. But time is running out for you to choose between enjoying the tropical paradise known as Cuba with me or breaking up ice dams on your roof. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls, how to make your walkway unslippery without killing your lawn and plants, and a great new program that trains returning servicemen to become organic farmers. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we have a clever new suggestion for you to safely make your walkways non-slippery during ice and snow events without harming your nearby lawn and plants and perhaps even improving their soil. How about that now? We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for a very special interview, something that holds well for the future of our veterans and our farms. The organic farming program teaching returning veterans to work farms. It's a great idea, and we have two people here to discuss it with us. Dennis Reiling, who's coordinator of the organic farming program through the Rodale Institute and Delaware Valley College here in the Philadelphia area. And Josh Brown, a Marine veteran who served for 8 years, deployed twice to Afghanistan, and was the first veteran to enroll in the organic farming program. Gentlemen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden. And before we even get started with that, thank you for your service as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
One thing I have to say personally is I have been really traumatized by all the stories of the difficulties our returning veterans have had in finding work, finding meaningful work when they get back from military service. It seems to have been a tremendous failure on our part to take care of these people, to train them. And at the same time, everyone knows, it's been in the news all the time, that farmers are getting older and retiring. There aren't new farmers coming along to take their place. A lot of times their kids aren't interested. There's no more meaningful work than growing food, and it really seemed to cover a huge gap in our returning veteran services. Now, Josh, how did you find out about the program?
When I got out of the Marines, I spent 3 years doing small jobs here and there and couldn't really hold one down. And then I'd actually gone to high school with Dennis Reiling, and he reached out to me on Facebook and asked if college was something I thought about and explained to me the program. And I said, sure, why not? I'll give it a shot. And I kind of jumped into it, and I've since completed it.
And it's a very intensive program, isn't it?
It is. There's a lot of hands-on work along with classroom work. You're not just reading books. You're out on the farms actually working and growing stuff, so you're learning how to do it while learning about it as well.
And it takes a year, and you amass a very large number of college credits during that year.
Yes, it's full one-year program, and you get the full 12 credits per semester, so you end up with 36 credits. And like I said, I've already completed the program, and I'm now transferring those credits into a full degree.
And what are you going to do with that degree?
Hopefully, once I get the degree, I can get a job with the Pennsylvania Game Commission doing land conservation management.
Okay. Now, Dennis, you are a veteran.
Yes.
And you helped create this program. What led you to do it?
Well, first of all, I went to Delaware Valley College for a degree in horticulture and commercial crop production. So last year, I finished up my degree, and the Dean of Agriculture, Russell Redding, actually reached out to me and explained the partnership they were starting to develop with the Rodale Institute. And I really felt that I was a good fit, number one, because I'm a Marine, and number two, because I had a degree in horticulture and the same classes that would be a part of the curriculum that we were developing. So that's kind of how it started.
But this isn't just happening at DelVal College and the Rodale Institute. This is happening all over the country, isn't it?
It really is. It's the last few years, it's been a big movement. There's the Veteran Farmer Coalition out of California, and they're kind of leading the way as far as organizing this and connecting with veterans, connecting with farmers, you know, helping veterans find access to land, capital, equipment, and so on and so on. There's Veterans to Farmers. There's a lot of programs that are happening, which is really good because that's what we need.
Josh, how are we going to get the word out to more veterans that this is the thing to do when you get back home? It seems to me like working outside in the fresh air and the sunshine might even be somewhat therapeutic after what you went through in Afghanistan, for instance.
I think a lot of that's kind of right on point. Working outside on the farm, you're in the dirt still where you're used to being. You're in the woods. You're dealing with people that you love to be with. You're dealing with other veterans for the most part as well if you're in the same type of work. And it's just working with your hands, which is what most veterans are used to doing. So you're not sitting in an office getting bored with yourself, but it's kind of intensive labor, but it keeps you moving all day long.
Because that is, I can imagine being in this intense situation. You served for 8 years where your adrenaline was up for, I would imagine, 8 years, right? And then you come back. It's not that you couldn't sit at a desk, but that would seem to be harder work than the work you did in the service, sitting at a desk after 8 years of adrenaline.
And it really was. Like I said, I held 3 jobs in the 3 years after I got out, and all 3 of those jobs were basically sitting at a desk doing paperwork, and it wasn't for me. That wasn't what I wanted to do. It kind of almost drove me nuts just sitting there not knowing that I was going to be doing anything. So kind of getting out and moving and being in the field, growing crops, running the tractors, planning stuff, working with tools, it was really nice because I'm actually being involved with something. I'm being active.
Now, Josh wants to go into wildlife management, which is, you know, being outdoors and things like that. Do you have people who are in the program who are centered on starting up or taking over a small farm somewhere?
Yeah, we actually have a student right now, Brandon Barnhart. He actually relocated from Indiana to come to the program. He has about a 3-acre farm in Indiana, so he came here specifically to learn how to farm, to work with, you know, we're working with him to set him up to get financing, USDA loans, farm loans, you know, and really developing that plan. So when he goes back in the spring, he'll be able to hit the ground running.
That's so true. In one sense, it's real easy to grow food once you have the equipment and the knowledge and the background. But then you have to know how to get your money's worth from it.
Yeah, that's the hardest part, I'd say, is the business aspect, is the marketing, like, you know, finding access to markets. You really need to have a market before you, you know, really go to that scale to start selling. And you need to have a plan. And that's where we can kind of help the college with the courses that they're taking. We have, for instance, they take a marketing horticultural products course that Josh took. And you write a marketing plan. You come up, you know, you do all of that. And I think that's the real difference because with that, like you said, you know, growing food, once you kind of get it down and the skills, it's the all of the business and fixing the equipment and managing people, which is, you know, the one real benefit that I think veterans returning already have the skills to do because, you know, most of them are coming from leadership roles. So, you know, they're really suited to manage an operation like that.
Josh, do you agree? Do you think that the military training you have and the camaraderie you develop would transfer to a farm situation?
I think it does to a large degree. Same as being out in the field with your Marine buddies or your soldiers or sailors or whoever you're with, you're working on a farm with the same group of people all day long, every day, and they become your family just like your brothers did in combat. So you're going to be working with them. You're going to learn to love them like family, hate them like family, fight and argue like family. But at the end of the day, you're all the same ones that are doing the same task to get the job done.
Now, Josh, you obviously have a lot of friends who like mustered out at the same time as you did. And how much was education on their mind? Because the GI Bill post 9/11 seems to be a real form of life support. Is it being underutilized?
I think it is at first. Kind of in the same situation as me. I went almost 3 years without even thinking about using it. But then once I realized that the workforce, you're going to start out kind of as the small man at the bottom, unless you have a degree, I think a lot of veterans are finding the same thing. Most of the guys I got out with, they were all just, oh, I'm going to become a cop, or I'm going to do this job, I'm going to work for this company. And they never really had a true plan of any type of future. But now a lot of them that I'm talking to are using the GI Bill. They are going to school, and they're realizing that it's a great tool to have.
Yes, Dennis.
A real problem that's happening is that veteran skills aren't really translating to the civilian sector. You know, some are, but it's really different application of them.
So what do we do? When I heard about this program, when I heard that it was local and we could get a couple of you guys into the studio, I jumped at the opportunity. I think this is the one of the best ideas I've heard since I've had this show. How do we get the word out more?
Well, this is hopefully going to help do that, thanks to You Bet Your Garden. But you know, we have the website, which is delval.edu/organic. We'll provide more information about the curriculum, about the program, and, you know, what we do is we give a tour of the campus and the farm and the greenhouses. And what we really try to do is figure out what the veterans' goals are and what they want to be doing. Because another thing that was happening with this program is, you know, I've talked to veterans, and then they've just decided from square one to go for a full 4-year degree program. So a lot of, you know, veterans contacted me for this program, but then really just, you know, made the commitment. And right now we have 3 or 4 new students just in the horticulture major at the college itself.
And it's not unusual for people to go to college out of state. As you mentioned, you got a guy who came from Indiana, and especially if you're going to a school where you know you'll get your housing stipend, you won't have to worry about it, you can really see if this is right for you. It's a great opportunity, and I hope we turn a couple people on to it by having you guys in the studio today.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Dennis Reiling is coordinator of the organic farming program at Delaware Valley College and the Rodale Institute. Josh Brown was the first veteran to enroll in the program. These programs are happening all over the country. We'll have a link to much more information on our website. Gentlemen, thank you again for your service, and thank you again for coming in today.
Thanks for having us. Yeah. Appreciate it.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello.
How are you today?
I am doing very well, Kim. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And where is Kim fine?
Newark, Delaware.
Oh, okay, right. And it's not, I have been corrected on this several times. And you know the mistake, right?
It is exactly Newark.
It's Newark.
You're putting yourself in the line of fire in Delaware if you say Newark.
Oh, exactly. Yes, yes. Yes, Newark is another place.
But exactly.
Here we go. Are you ready for it now? What can we do for Kim in Newark, Delaware?
I am wondering at this late date in the season if it is still okay to plant spring bulbs.
Do you have the spring bulbs in hand?
I do not. And I was on Burpee's website a couple of weeks ago, and there were some, but lots of them were sold out. But I did see some in a local store that were still available for purchase last weekend.
So you really want these things? This isn't a question.
I really do. I want to plant some.
Okay. And do you know what the store still has? You know, spring bulbs are a big kind of category.
I'd like to plant tulips and or daffodils.
Okay. The first answer is they'll probably give them to you almost. Yeah, I mean, you realize you got to get them for like 75% off if you're going to do this, right?
Oh, okay.
Because these bulbs are not going to last till next year. You know, if the nursery doesn't sell them to you and can still find them, because, you know, they've got out their giant inflatable Homer Simpson Santa Clauses already. They should sell them to you at a really bargain price. And then, yes, the advice is if you still have spring bulbs at this time of year, the best thing to do is just put them in the ground and hope for the best. These things actually are pretty tough. They would have preferred to go into the ground a month or two ago. But, you know, with Thanksgiving being the cutoff date, you're not that much out of whack. And especially the tulips. The tulips were really, especially in the hands of someone who hasn't done what I'm about to suggest next, the tulips are going to do best in the ground. But be aware that evil squirrels love to dig up and eat tulips. Tulip bulbs are totally edible. So creatures like voles and rabbits and other underground plant nibblers love to eat tulips. Now, deer eat them after they bloom, which may be even worse. So, you know, you wait till your soil is unfrozen, you know, pick a nice stretch and put the tulips in the ground. Make sure there's...
How deeply?
The best rule with spring bulbs is you bury them deeply enough so that you could put another bulb on top of them.
Okay.
But don't do that, of course. Just put dirt on top of them.
Okay.
And then when you're done with tulips and crocus, which are the most edible and appetizing bulbs, make sure you clean up all your bulb trash. Don't leave any wrappers out. That's like a neon sign saying, come eat here.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you have a dog, or do you know anybody who's got a dog?
Our neighbor does have a dog.
What you want to do is after they're planted, brush the dog or ask the neighbor to brush the dog, and even better, to bring the dog over and brush it on top of that planting bed. Dogs hate squirrels, and squirrels are terrified of dogs. Deer and evil squirrels will not go near anywhere that they can smell a dog. So, and don't be afraid to replenish the dog hair on top over the course of the season.
Okay.
Now, daffodils, you don't have to worry about. They're poisonous. So nothing eats those. Those are safe from predation. But do you perhaps have a secondary fridge in your house? Something like a beer fridge or...
Yes.
You do?
a small refrigerator.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What you can do is with the daffodils, you can pot them up in pots. Get a really nice, light, loose potting soil. Put the daffodils in, same thing, with enough room on top for there to have been another bulb. Really pack them into the pots, though. They can be side to side.
Okay.
And then totally saturate the pot with water until it's really, you know, dripping wet. Then let it drain somewhere. And then put a label on it that has the name of the plant, not only the daffodil but the variety.
Okay.
And put it in the fridge. And then just leave it alone for 16 weeks. At the end of 16 weeks, bring it out, put it outside, and water it, and it should sprout. You will have forced them in the fridge where the conditions are maybe even a little bit better than outdoors. The ideal is to keep that fridge right around 40 degrees. They shouldn't freeze. They shouldn't be above 50 degrees. And the only thing you have to remember is you can't keep any fruit in that fridge.
Okay.
All of my daffodils put on such a good show that relatives I gave them to have asked me to do it for them again this year.
Wonderful. I appreciate your help, Mike.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and recommend a few great gifts for gardeners. A motion-activated sprinkler for chasing away deer and evil squirrels. A propane-powered flame weeder to remove plants growing in the wrong place. A worm bin to turn your worst waste into garden gold. An attractive outdoor composter for gardeners without room for a big pile. And baseball batting gloves for hand protection your gardener will always use. But don't you go looking for all the details in the A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to keep your walkways non-slippery over winter without any harm to your lawn or plants. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in this stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, in which we review the best practices for plant-safe ice melting and reveal a new suggestion that not only will keep your walkway non-icy, but if it gets on your lawn and plants, could improve their soil. You won't want to miss it. And you won't. It's coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Vincent, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mac. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm at Wallingford, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Exactly.
All right. What can we do for Vincent in Wallingford, PA?
A couple of years back now, I've noticed that come fall, the crows start digging up and pulling on my lawns. For the past 4 years now, I was wondering if there's something I could do apart from using chemicals, you know.
I'm not even sure what kind of a anti-crow chemical might even exist there, man. So this is unusual. Crows, unfortunately, as you may know or have heard, crows are some of the most intelligent creatures we have in our environment. I would say in terms of ability to learn, and I believe they can even use tools. They're the smartest in the bird family, and they have a reputation for being really crafty as well. So you say a flock of crows shows up every fall,
yeah,
and starts digging in your lawn,
yeah,
with their beaks, I'm presuming.
Yeah, exactly. I have a feeling that, you know, there might be some grub that they're digging for.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
There's only three things that I can think of that would interest them. And they're really the same things that would attract moles underground. And that is, as you note, beetle grubs. What we're talking about is Japanese beetles, rose chafer beetles, the brightly colored scarab beetles. They're the ones that the females lay their eggs in the lawns. The eggs develop into grubs, and the grubs all do eat vast amounts of lawn roots. So in this case, if that's what the crows are doing, they're probably keeping your lawn alive, although, you know, even if it's not bad luck, it sure looks like bad luck to have a lawn full of crows. You know, that's just not exactly. It may be good at Halloween, just that one day for them to be there. Then you can save on decorations.
Yeah, yeah.
They could also be eating earthworms or cicada larvae, but I think your answer is correct. So you know what I want you to do,
yeah,
is two things. The best way to control lawn grubs long term, and unfortunately you have a long time to prepare for this, there's a natural control called milky spore disease. And what this is, it's a naturally occurring soil organism that once a grub ingests it, the grub dies, and then the grub develops this disease and spreads this disease throughout the lawn. But the lawn only affects beetle grubs. It doesn't even harm earthworms.
I see.
And it's postulated this is why Japanese beetles aren't a problem in Japan, because this naturally occurring organism is in their soils over there. So we add it artificially to ours. Now, you'll see milky spore disease for sale in every garden center in America in the spring. You're welcome to buy it then, but store it in a cool, dry place until July or August, because unfortunately, milky spore doesn't work in the spring.
I see.
Milky spore only works when the soil is around 70 degrees and the grubs are actively feeding. And that's July and August and early September.
So
just about the same time that your crows show up is the time that you would spread this natural disease control on your lawn. And then you would want to chase away the crows, however.
Yeah, because, like you say, they're really smart. You put some scarecrows, they figure out eventually that these are no threat.
Scarecrows are from Warner Brothers cartoons. Scarecrows are like the straight men for crows. No, what you need is a product that you're going to love if you have deer or cats coming onto your landscape.
I see.
But it is a motion-activated sprinkler. You hook it up to your hose.
Mm-hmm.
You point it at the area you don't want animals or other creatures to be running around in. And as soon as something breaks the beam, the sprinkler comes on and throws a couple of cups of cold water at them. Well, it's not the kind of thing that crows can ignore or get used to. And it's almost like with the name of the product, you'd think it was designed to prevent crows from doing this, but mostly it's used against deer, cats, raccoons, things like that, groundhogs. But crows would be the perfect, I mean, they'd activate it as they came landing in. So you set up this sprinkler to keep the crows off your lawn next fall. Late next summer, you treat it with milky spore. I'll bet you the crows are so smart that the first crow that shows up the following fall is going to turn around and go to the other crows. There's no more grubs here. We got to go someplace else. Because once you use milky spore successfully in the fall, or late summer, really, it inoculates your lawn for decades. All right, man?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mike.
Well, thank you. That was a great question. Lots of fun.
All right, now.
Take care.
I enjoy your program.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marcia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Hello.
Hello, Marcia. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
And where does Marcia do fine?
Mount Holly, New Jersey.
Where there must be holly bushes growing galore on mounds, right? Mount Holly.
It's a small mound, but it was historical in the Revolution, so they've saved it. And there's a lot of holly trees around.
Oh, so there is a mount in Mount Holly, so to speak?
Yeah. Yeah, a small one. Yeah.
Okay, very good. I didn't know that. I've learned something already. All right, what can we do for Marcia and Mount Holly?
Well, I heard the show a few weeks ago about the berries in the wet ground.
Oh, right. We had a guy who had bought land that flooded a lot and that had a high water table, and he had wanted to grow fruit trees there.
Yeah.
And I was struggling to come up with any kind of fruit that would grow in wet soil. And the only thing I could find as I was frantically going through my research books is black elderberry, which is a very valuable plant. And there's a lot of ornamental varieties of it. Do you have something else to suggest?
Serviceberry. It's got a lot of other names, but it's a native in North America. And there's quite a few varieties, and they will grow in shade and sun, in wet and dry. They're actually pretty tolerant, pretty tough plants. And the fruit is a lot like a blueberry. It tastes a lot like a blueberry. Where I grew up in North Dakota, we called them June berries.
Huh.
They'll take quite a bit of water. I first started growing a serviceberry here because the front yard is like a bog.
Right.
About 6 months out of the year, it's really wet. And then in the summertime, it's bone dry because it's clay. And the tree is fine. Lots of fruit. The only thing is the birds get more of it than we do. So that's a hazard with the berries.
Well, it's not really a hazard. I'm so glad that you called. First of all, because as you know from probably your own kind of bog dry garden, that's a really hard condition to find plants to thrive in, and especially edible plants. But you remind me that the serviceberry is like a champion of so many categories of garden enthusiasts, fruit lovers, fruit growers really praise this plant. Native plant lovers use this plant as an example of like a shining star of a native plant. And I believe the common name serviceberry refers to the fact that it provides so many services to people and wildlife. As you yourself note, the berries are wonderfully edible and juicy for humans. But, you know, there's a lot of people who grow the plants just to feed wildlife naturally. And, you know, the plant is a big shrubby half kind of a tree thing that's very full. So it provides a lot of shelter and protection for wildlife. I've talked to many people over the years who've considered serviceberry about as close to a perfect plant as you can find.
There's a lot of them to pick from. There's some that are short and some that get pretty big. But
they are all spectacular plants with great berries. Marcia, I'm so glad you called up to make me think about service berries again and to add that to the list of edible plants that grow on wet land. Thank you so much, Marcia.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
All right, you take care now.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. A plant-safe ice-melting update. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you kindly read this week's question?
Sure, Mike. John in Kensington, Maryland writes, I have a stamped concrete walkway surrounded by a lot of mature foundation plants. The little research I've read suggests that I should not use magnesium chloride, calcium chloride, or potassium chloride because it degrades cement. Can you suggest another alternative? Play sand, kitty litter? I don't have access to wood ashes. Mike, I seem to recall that you have trouble with concrete versus cement.
Oh, yeah. And so that was the first thing my poor dyslexic self went running to check. Turns out it's a little bit like all pumpkins are squash, but not all squash are pumpkins. All concrete contains cement, but cement is not concrete. Cement is a combination of several ingredients, including, interestingly, iron and aluminum, and it can be used alone as a building material, but it isn't nearly as durable as concrete, which is mostly crushed up rocks and sand held together with cement.
So all concrete contains cement?
Yeah, but often not a lot. Most of the material in concrete is the aggregate, the crushed up stone and sand and such. The cement content of concrete may be as low as 10%.
And we've suddenly become You Bet Your Building Materials because?
Because warnings about what you can use on cement really don't apply to concrete, which is much more durable. And which explains why my stamped concrete patio hasn't been harmed by any of the three de-icing chemicals our listener names.
Calcium chloride, potassium chloride, and magnesium chloride. You've used them all?
Yeah, when winter hits, I buy a couple of shaker jugs of whatever I can find that doesn't contain rock salt, which really does harm nearby lawns and plants. Then I always remember to follow the best practices I learned years ago in an interview with Russ Alger, director of the Institute of Snow Research at Michigan Tech University, where they receive an average of 25 feet of lake effect snow every winter.
And those best practices are?
If you know you're going to get weather that'll make your surfaces icy, like freezing rain overnight, pre-treat your walkways with just a little bit of de-icer before the event hits. Just a small amount will prevent ice from ever forming. Then you can take that first step outside without falling on your keister the next morning.
And what about if we're expecting real snow?
Then as the song goes, let it snow, and wait to apply any de-icer until after all your shoveling is done. Don't toss any shoveled snow that may have been hit with road salt onto your lawn or plants, but do toss clean snow onto your lawn and plants. Snow is a great insulator and plant protector, and the more clean snow, the more any de-icer that gets near your plants is going to be diluted.
Do you have any preference between the alternative de-icers?
Well, calcium chloride is the one I see around the most, and it also works at the lowest temperatures. But all three are much gentler on plants than rock salt, which people often choose simply because it seems to be less expensive.
Why do you say seems to be?
Well, the low cost doesn't take into account the long-term damage that rock salt can cause to plants and surfaces. And you can melt the same amount of ice with so much less of one of these alternatives that they wind up costing about the same. You just have to train yourself to use those really small amounts.
And what about play sand and kitty litter?
Ha! I tried kitty litter once and it made a huge mess. But my good friend Howard Garrett, the dirt doctor who preaches the gospel of organics down in Texas, likes sand quite a bit. He says that the Texas Highway Department spreads something called concrete sand on their icy roads, and it works very well, and of course it's totally non-pollutional.
Pollutional?
Yeah, if that's not a real word, it should be. Anyway, for home use, Howard recommends lava sand or granite sand, both of which he notes are nice little soil improvers, especially lava sand, which he's always singing the praises of.
But where can you get it, and where does play sand fit in?
Well, lava sand is sold in big bags as a soil amendment and for use in potting mixes. You should be able to find it at hipper garden centers. For reliable information on what kind of regular sand homeowners should look for, I called QuickCrete, the big national supplier of concrete aggregates and sand. They were incredibly nice and helpful and explained that, quote, all-purpose sand, the type you're most likely to find at big home stores, is the kind that's used to make icy surfaces safe. Play sand is a more specialized product that's designed to be safer for kids to roll around in, but it de-slipperizes ice just as well.
But won't you track the sand into the house?
You'll track in anything you use on your walkway, whether it's sand, salt, or whatever. That's why people who live where they have real winters need a boot scraper, a mudroom carpet, or just to take their shoes off before they walk anywhere nice inside. Well, that sure was some good information about making your walkway safe without killing your poor plants, now wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who want more detail, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to rock my salt if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And if you do send us an email, please, please, please tell us where you live, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and see what's new every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Special thanks to Josh Brown and Dennis Reiling for coming into the studio today to discuss the great organic farming program for veterans at Del Valle College and the Rodale Institute. Look for more information on the program at our website. Our Sandy staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your slippery host, Mike McGrath. And I'll see you next week. Are weeds fresh from the sea good for your garden or a sucker punch of salt? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what to do if you find a pile of seaweed on the shore. Plus your fabulous phone calls.